My name's Steve Mitchell. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight. Glad to be sober. Glad to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and honored to be in your presence. I want to thank Bob for the invitation, for picking me up at the airport, hanging out with Leslie today. That was a trip. I can't imagine her drunk. What that must have been like. She appears to be barely street legal sober. But I'm thrilled to be here, and for the kind hospitality at the groceries tonight at Rich's house, and that's where I'm going to live tonight. And if you've been homeless like I have, you're always grateful for a place to live, no matter how long you've been sober. So I really am glad to be here. I want to let you know I got a sobriety date. It's May 26, 1975. I'm a member of a group. I'm a member of the Principals group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Raleigh, North Carolina. I don't know if it's the best group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world or not. I haven't been to all of them. I know it's the best one for me. I've got a sponsor. I don't know if he's the best sponsor in the world or not. I just know he's the best sponsor for me. Now, what I'm going to do tonight is going to take about 2 or 3 hours here. I'm from Nebraska, and I went to North Carolina in 1989. And when I got there, a guy said, "I'd like to give you some advice if I could." And I don't know anything in the world more worthless than advice for an alcoholic. We don't even take it when we ask for it, let alone advice that ain't solicited. He said, most meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in North Carolina start at 8 o'clock at night. And you don't ever have to worry about being alone in Alcoholics Anonymous unless you talk 5 minutes after 9 at night. So, and I know that none of us ever got drunk late at night. So, all of those things. If you're new here, I'd like to welcome you too, just like Gemma did, and I think the chair. If you are new, in a very real sense, there's no such thing as a speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a speaker. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who sometimes gets asked to participate through speaking, and I'd never want to be thought of as a speaker. I'm a member, and I've taken advantage of everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. I'm not an expert on anything. I am an expert on one thing, and sometimes I'm reluctant to say this. I'm an expert on trying to practice these principles to the best of my ability. I'm not an expert on the principles. I'm an expert on trying to practice them the best of my ability. I have diligently rolled up my sleeves and done the best I could. I was sober 20 years when I finally realized at a cellular level that I'd done the best I could do drinking, and I'd done the best I could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And with that, I can assure you, came a great deal of freedom. I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous is a snake bite kit not to drink alcohol. What I think Alcoholics Anonymous is, well, first of all, what I think alcoholism is. If somebody asked me, what do you think alcoholism is? I would say, for me, it means I can't live with drinking and I can't live without drinking. That's what I think alcoholism is. The very first time I heard someone say that the majority of alcoholics who kill themselves do it sober, nobody had to describe that to me. Nobody had to explain that to me. That made eminent sense to me then and now. I'm all for drinking. One reason I'm for drinking, that's where we get our members. And if booze still did what it did for me when I was an 18-year-old kid, I don't mind telling you, that's where I'd be tonight. I'd be in one of those broken-down country western bars. I'd have some half-dressed slingstress in there with me. She'd be telling me how good I am, and she would know it was a lie, and I would too, but what difference does that make? I mean, honesty's not exactly a high-quality virtue in there. You ever have that moment of clarity when you're drinking? Now, you can kill clarity like you can anything else. I had a moment of clarity one day. I was in a place called Bill's Bar that I'll talk a little bit about here in a minute. And I was talking to a friend of mine. He was a bit of a minor celebrity in Bill's Bar in that he'd had a case overturned while he was in the penitentiary. Nebraska Supreme Court had overturned his case and he had gotten out of prison early. In Bill's, that was enough to make you a minor celebrity. But he was telling me, you know how two drunks will sit up there and tell each other things? We were sitting up at the bar and that country music played all the time in there. Even today, I question people's alcoholism that don't listen to country music. I mean, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you'd have. May not be an alcoholic. Might just be a heavy drinker. But that country music would play all the time. And so my buddy was telling me, his name's Stuart, and he's telling me about how much money he had made as a burglar the year he was married to a girl named Karen. Now, I know Karen. And he would say, I did this burglary this year, and I was married to Karen that year. And so I'm listening. And I don't know why this happened, but just for a second, it was like I had good sense. He was lying to me and I was lying to him. But just like for just a little nit ray there, I had good sense. And I said, well, Stuart, how much money did you make? And for just like a second, he had good sense. He looked back over at me and he said it never was enough to make a living. And then he went back to lying and I went back to lying. And that's the way you have it in the bar. I mean, you have some brilliant things in there. You have shuffleboard, things like that. I mean, one drunk shoves a puck down this way and the other drunk throws it back. I mean, and it goes like that, you know, not only day after day after day, but year after year after year. Where I'm from in Nebraska, people are Catholic about like they're Baptist in North Carolina. And I was talking to somebody, he said at the dinner, I think it might have been Rich, said something about his cousin or somebody married a good Baptist girl in North Carolina. I said, well, if you're from North Carolina, your chances of anybody you running into being Baptist are about 95%. But where I'm from in Nebraska, people are Catholic about like they're Baptist in North Carolina. And Catholic schools everywhere. When we lived in Nebraska, my kids went to Catholic school, and they take the money right out of your contribution, and it's not exorbitant. Anybody can go to Catholic school that wants to, and there's Catholic schools all over metropolitan Omaha. And you've seen athletes go to the free throw line or up to the batter's box and cross themselves like that, or at the boxing matches. And one night at the boxing matches, every time the bell rang, one of the fighters stood up and he crossed himself like this. And there was a Catholic priest on the other side of the ring, and you know that collar is a lightning rod for a drunk. And so the drunk kept watching that, and finally he wandered over to the priest, and he said, that's one of your boys, isn't it? And the priest says, well, yes, he appears to be a Roman Catholic. And he said, well, when he keeps doing that, he said, what does that mean? He said, well, he's crossing himself in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And the drunk said to the priest, will it help him? And the priest leaned back over and said, it'll help him if he can fight. And that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous is. It'll help us if we do the stuff that we're supposed to do. I don't think you're going to reverse a killer illness. If you're new in here tonight or any, I don't think you're going to reverse a killer illness by coming into a few meetings and talking about who shot John. Just like our literature tells us, it takes depth and weight to reverse a killer illness. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I don't live in fear of the first drink. I don't think I've come close to drinking since I've been sober about a year and a half. Now, I've come close to losing my mind a couple times at 8 years and at 19 and a half years. And Bill Wilson talked about that as a dark night of the soul. And I can tell you, pain is hard to capture. It's hard to reach out and be able to talk about. But the best I can talk about that is it made homeless be like kid stuff. It felt like I was being choked spiritually. But when I was sober about a year and a half, I remember telling my great aunt that I think I've ran into something that I won't ever have to drink again one day at a time unless I demand to. I think I'm on pretty firm ground with that. We don't talk about it in those terms. But any alcoholic that I've ever worked intimately with, or anybody that's ever been ahead of me, or anybody that's ever shared with me at a cellular level, has shared that they come upon a period of time through the practice of these principles and anchoring down here that they knew, unless they demanded to, they would never have to drink again one day at a time. I think I'm on pretty firm ground with that. It's written down in our history. They asked Dr. Bob that question, do you think you'll ever drink again? He said, I don't think I'll ever drink again one day at a time unless I quit doing what I've been doing right up till now. See, if I could put all the jets of Alcoholics Anonymous in place at one time and still drink alcohol, then we wouldn't have a miracle here. What we would have here is a crapshoot. So how I would describe Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life slightly more powerful than the illness of alcoholism. But that's only if I put all the jets in place. What I think AA is made up of a series of parts of many great parts of a whole. And at the pinnacle of that, of course, is the 12 steps. And I want to share my experience with those steps tonight. So what I want to do is I want to get drunk, and I'm all for talking about drinking. Sometimes you hear alcoholics say that they don't like to hear about drinking. I can't imagine what kind of alcoholic that would be. I mean, I don't want to hit you with anything too heavy tonight, but alcoholics half our name. I mean, you'll hear people say that sometimes it's not how much you drink. I've never run into an alcoholic that didn't drink a lot, have you? I mean, what? Good God Almighty. What? I mean, I don't want us to get so pristine that we don't talk about drinking and throwing up and all of those things. I want to tell you one of those goofy stories, too. You got to be careful what you'll say you'll never do, because my experience is when you take a stand like that, you usually end up holding it. But I'm going to take a chance on this. out in the country in North Carolina and out in the country in Nebraska, people are buying old houses and renovating them. And over a period of time, they're pounding them into something really nice. And sometimes they move into them, and sometimes they sell them for a great profit. There's a whole bunch of that stuff going on about 30 or 40 miles from where I live. I sponsor a guy down there out in the country where they're doing that. And there was this young couple that bought this house, and they were renovating it. They had to clear the land, and they did that, and it was just nasty out there. And over a period of time, they began to pound this into something that really looked good. And it's really looking nice. There was an old country minister and his wife who, after church on Sunday, went past there on their way home, and they became more and more intrigued with the way this house was starting to come alive and look really nice. And the minister was really impressed by this. Now, he was a little bit concerned. Minister was a pretty good guy, but just a thread sanctimonious. And he was a little bit concerned that these folks weren't in church. But he had made up his mind that one of these days he was going to stop and talk to this couple, and that's what he did. And so the conversation was going pretty well. And he was talking to the guy who had done most of the work. And the house was almost done. They were almost ready to move into it. And the minister said to the guy, he said, "Isn't it amazing what God can do?" The guy looked back over at him and said, "Yes, it is. But remember what this place looked like last year at this time when God had it all by himself." Now, I think that that's analogous to Alcoholics Anonymous as well. We read almost every meeting that we go to that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I believe that. I believe everything that it says in Alcoholics Anonymous literature applies to me except one thing that I just take a bit of license to disagree with. I don't agree with that thing for me where it says it's the great obsession of every alcoholic to be a normal drinker. I can't imagine anything more boring than being a normal drinker. You might as well go bowling. We got a guy in my home group, great guy, sober 25 years. I just found out he's back to bowling. I said, "Man, I'm worried about you, Haywood. I just don't think I'm going to go bowling." Anyway, now I forgot why I was telling that. There was some reason. Doesn't matter. I forget where I'm at so much it doesn't embarrass me. The only thing that's embarrassing is if nobody else remembers, and I can't get going, means nobody else is listening. Anyway, it doesn't matter much. You know, one of the things that is really powerful about Alcoholics Anonymous is how we come together. Oh, I know what I wanted to talk about, that very thing. It says that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Now, I believe that. All right? But again, if you listen even more than casually, but if you listen fairly well, you'll hear everybody who gets sober and begins to recover at a real depth level from the illness of alcoholism points their sobriety to somebody. They always point it. That seems to be the way God worked it out, didn't he? Could have worked it out any way he wanted to, but he worked it out that one drunk would go get another drunk and put us on the high road. Guy told me one time, he said, you follow me and I'll cut you a path. And he did that. I heard Vince Lombardi say one time that Freddie Thurston was the greatest pulling guard the NFL ever saw. And he could have never been any better at that than the guy that was knocking down problems for me. It was the most amazing thing. And all I really had to do was drink myself almost to death and come in here. I want to let you know just a little bit about my drinking. I think the 10-minute speaker said she started drinking at age 15. That's what I did. I grew up in alcoholism. All the men on both sides of my family, bad alcoholics. I think Nebraska is textbook alcoholism in that people have a wonderful sense of right and wrong there. They have a wonderful sense of work ethic. I'm not from the farm, but my grandparents were. And it's a hard work, and it's honesty, and it's the kind of honesty like this. If you went in a grocery store and you bought a carton of cigarettes with a $50 bill and they gave you change for $100, you'd give it back. Now, I was introduced to all of that. I was never afflicted with any of it. I knew about it, but I never agreed with any of it. I had a grandfather, bad case of alcoholism, wouldn't go fishing on his own property without a fishing license. They knew about right and wrong. They knew about honesty, but yet those same people would stay out there and drink themselves to death. So I don't think that you could make any kind of a case that I'm sober here tonight because of good moral fiber. I know that men and women of much better moral fiber than me have drank themselves to death. One of the great mysteries, Bill Wilson said, that the alcoholic, more than most, seems to want to know what it's all about. And I always did too. If top of the line of the things I've got from Alcoholics Anonymous is I know exactly what my job in life is. In fact is, I would go so far as to say that of all the things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, we probably do 1,000 different things. As far as I know, we do everything we do in Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons. One is to stay sober, and the other one is to carry the message. That's why we do everything we do. And if we do that, you know, I would have settled for table scraps, and what I got was a seat at the banquet with the king, all because of that. I heard a guy say one time that I don't think he says this anymore, but I just saw him recently. He used to say this all the time, that you don't have to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous other than practice these principles to the best of your ability. If you do that, everything that's necessary for your fulfillment in life will automatically come into your life. You don't have to do anything to remove what's hindering or harming your fulfillment in life. It'll automatically be removed through the practice of these principles. And the way I look at all that stuff is, for example, there's big money in my family on both sides. Now, I don't ever have to worry about any of it coming my way. Fact is, I had a guy tell me one time, I wouldn't give you a penny if you needed a new heart. Now, I wondered if he could really explain what he meant. But I've got a great aunt and uncle who have their name on a building at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. You got to give several million for that. But I don't have any other way of getting any money than working for it. So if I'm going to practice these principles, I'm going to have to work. And it goes like that. I mean, there's things that we're going to have to do. We're going to have to roll up our sleeves. But nevertheless, we have a way of life. It looks like to me that there's two basic ways people approach Alcoholics Anonymous. One is the man or woman who's socialized into the kind of AA. If you put these principles first, then that's all you have to do. Everything else will automatically happen. I've been tracking that. If I can make it till May 26th, it'll be 31 years. So far, right up till today, I've not seen one single case of failure of a person who put these principles at first in their life. No matter what the tragedy, no matter what the provocation, no matter what the reversal, I've never seen one single case of failure. The other way it looks like to me people approach Alcoholics Anonymous today, and it looks like to me, unfortunately, this may be the bigger way, is they try to patch up all areas of their life where they're leaking, thinking their alcoholism will go away. That makes more sense, doesn't it? It just doesn't work. Alcoholism's illogical. It just doesn't make sense. I want to just tell you a very few things about my drink, and then I want to get rolling. I want to talk tonight. I asked Bob if this was all right. I didn't know if you just had to share your experience here. But I want to share my experience with the steps, because that's what made me a free man. That's what's made it impossible for me to drink unless I demand to drink. Could I get drunk? Of course I could get drunk. Any alcoholic could get drunk. But I'm not going to just walk off and get drunk. I've got to pull out, don't I? I've done a lot of things today to ensure not drinking. I woke up in a home in Raleigh, North Carolina. My wife was there. She was seemingly glad I was there. She knew me. I knew her. You remember that deal from the bar, that last call for alcohol and that last chance for romance? Now, sometimes that works out pretty good, and sometimes it's pretty rough, ain't it? I heard a former sponsor of mine say one time, now, listen close, he said this, not me. He woke up one time, and it was obvious there was somebody in there that he didn't know. And he looked around and he shot up a quick prayer. He said, please, God, let it be a woman. You know, I mean, it can be pretty rough. But I woke up, got on my knees, renewed the contract with the boss, read Alcoholics Anonymous literature, went about God's will about getting here today, hung out with AA people here today. I'm not going to just walk off and get drunk. I'd have to pull out of this. I'm protected here. I'm anchored down. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. As long as I continue to put these principles first in my life, then God's miracle is going to continue to manifest in my life. But let me tell you a little bit about my drinking. It was always nasty and it was always out of control. Our literature says something to the effect that the story of any alcoholic, some of it's hilarious and some of it's tragic. Now, I had some hilarious things happen. Three years ago, my wife and I were in California, and we went to all those goofy sitcoms like Everybody Loves Raymond and Will and Grace and watched them being made. And it's something I never would have done, but it really was fun. I think you could have made a sitcom out of some of the stuff that happened when I was drinking if you knew how to do it. I left the bar in the wrong car one time. I drove a car to the bar. It was white, the car was, and I had a woman with me. This story's always a little bit delicate, and it's a little bit sensitive. This woman was not ugly. She, however, was old. And I told this story one night in Decatur, Alabama, and a lady right down in the front row said, you mean mature, don't you? And I said, no. No, I don't. I don't mean mature. There just ain't no way to make that mature. But anyway, what happened is that in those days, I never took the keys out of a car. And most of this was pieced together later for me by the highway patrol. This lady and I went in the bar. And sometime later, we came out of the bar. This was out in the country. And we left in a white car. It had been driven to the bar by somebody and got out and left the keys in it. And the car we drove to the bar, we left there. And a couple hours later, I was arrested for auto theft and drunk driving. Now, they put this woman and I in the same jail cell while this state patrolman who'd arrested us and this little night marshal tried to get to the bottom of this. And in the morning, they let us out. It took me a long time to figure out what had happened. In the morning when they let us out, you know how you tell something so many times or you can't be sure it actually happened or you just think it happened? Now, this story is true in every detail. And the thing I'm a little bit uncertain about, but I'm almost certain they even gave us the beer back the next morning. It was a different time. But I never will forget, if I live to be 1,000 years old, standing out in front of that jail that morning and that state patrolman punching me in the chest. Now, this woman I had with me, I told you she was old. She'd be about 85 today. No embellishment on this story now. And she had on these little bitty white shorts, and about half her butt was coming out the bottom. It's rough. And the next morning, I remember that patrolman poking me in the chest saying, "She has to drive, you're too drunk." I said, "All right with me, boss." But she was walking ahead of me, and I was walking behind her. And you know, that patrolman was standing up in front of the jail like this. And I got about almost probably as far as to the back of the room, and I turned around and looked at the patrolman. And you know how that'll happen? Our eyes locked. Just like our eyes were locked. And I saw him go like this. He went. And now, I wasn't able at that time, but if I would have been able, what I would have said is, "Buddy, those are my sentiments exactly. If you think it's rough where you're at, how would you like to be me?" And this poor woman didn't have any day at the beach with me either. Now, those kind of things happen time after time after time. I was hitchhiking one time. People in Nebraska go to California to start their life over. If you could hark back to Fremont, Nebraska tonight, there's somebody going to California to start their life over. I made that trip several times, and you can imagine my consternation when I got there, and I was there. But I was hitchhiking one time from Fremont, Nebraska, running away from the law. I was in a place called Little America, Wyoming. I'm going to San Gabriel, California to a drunken uncle of mine. And a guy came by and picked me up and took me to Portland, Oregon and dropped me off. I'm now further from San Gabriel than where he got me. And those things happen, you know, time after time after time. But anyway, Thanksgiving season of 1974, I ended back up in Nebraska, and I would come and go a lot. I don't know. I know there's a lot of bars in Nevada. I'm always shocked in North Carolina how few bars there are. Now, people apparently don't have any trouble getting respectfully drunk in North Carolina, but there's bars everywhere in Nebraska and very few bars in North Carolina now. I sobered up at a place called Chapter 5 right between two bars. Didn't make much difference because I wasn't allowed to go in either bar anyway. But right up the street was a place called Bill's Bar. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that the majority of people who drink alcohol drink it with control. And I'm also well aware of the fact that I can't diagnose anybody else's alcoholism. If I think somebody's an alcoholic, but they don't think they are, it's not worth it. Doesn't mean nothing, does it? Everybody's got to be converted individually, don't they? Everybody has to own their own alcoholism. I have to believe I'm an alcoholic. Doesn't matter what anybody else believes, I have to believe that. Now, with all of that said, I'm going to take a chance on those people at Bill's Bar. At that time, you could have literally backed one of those farm trucks up to Bill's Bar and put everybody in there and carted them to Alcoholics Anonymous. You wouldn't have missed a person. You had to be drunk to stand it in there. The people that worked in there were drunk. Bill had bought that bar as a toy for his drunken wife, Phyllis. And we had some colorful characters in that bar. We had a guy named Vibrator Hartman. And Vibrator got drunk one New Year's Eve and burned up in a fire. And Vibrator's claim to fame was he had sat in the county jail one time for a year and a half. And the Nebraska Supreme Court had said if somebody's going to stay in jail that long, they needed to be released or sent on to the penitentiary. And Vibrator would get drunk and tell that story over and over and over. We had a guy named Rodney Montaney. Rodney got drunk, got in a fight with a guy in a wheelchair and tipped him over. That ain't good. The way Rodney described that, he said, "He hit me a good one, Steve, but I tipped him over before they got me out of there." You know, we had another guy in there named Leonard Larson. Now, Leonard had no neck. Leonard's head sat right on his shoulders. And Leonard had taken one too many shots to the head. He was punchy. And well, after I got out of the military, my fighting weight at that time was about 130 pounds. Leonard used to get me to jump off bar stools onto his stomach to perform feats of strength. And Leonard would get drunk and crawl around on his hands and knees and lift bar stools. We had a guy say one time at midnight in the bar, Leonard can lift everything in here but his own body. Now, metropolitan Omaha is hilly, and there's some hills in Nebraska, but most of Nebraska is flat. It's ranch and cattle and corn country and railroad and trucking industry and a lot of old laws on the books. Leonard went out in the country one day and shot a cow, stumbled out to a country road to help get somebody to help him load it in his pickup truck, and he waved down an off-duty deputy sheriff. Got 1 to 2 years for that. We had a guy named Pee-wee Holtgren. Now, Pee-wee would get drunk, and he would just be dead weight. Couldn't move Pee-wee. It'd take a hoist to move him. And the police would walk through there on Friday and Saturday night, and we'd just hold Pee-wee's head up so they'd see it in that big mirror, and they'd get on the other side. They'd just drop Pee-wee. He didn't know it. He wasn't there. But the two most colorful characters came in there were two brothers named Billy and Tommy Walker. And now, I'm a beer drinker, but I'll drink anything. That lady that talked before spoke of that Mad Dog wine. That wine's got what got me to seeing stuff that wasn't there. But basically, I'm a beer drinker, but I'll drink anything. Now, when Billy and Tommy Walker came to town, they fell right into Bill's bar. Water always seeks its own level, doesn't it? If you go in the same bar at the same time every day, I don't care if it's a cow town out in the country in Nebraska or downtown San Francisco, you'll see the same people. I was gone from some of those bars in Nebraska for as long as a year at a time and went back in there, and people were sitting on the same bar stools that they were last year when I left. Some of them had the same baseball caps on. They'd driven their trucks faster. They'd knocked more people out. They'd slept with more women than they had than ever. Everybody, including me and them, knew they hadn't left the bar. But again, honesty's not exactly a virtue in there. But anyway, Billy and Tommy Walker came to town. Now, Billy Walker drank dry gin and chased it with Squirt. We don't even have Squirt in North Carolina, but all it is a kind of soda. Now, this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at this time. One of the reasons I tell you this story is this is where the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous started to move in my life, was right in Bill's bar. But anyway, Billy Walker drank that dry gin and chased it with Squirt, so I started drinking that. And he told me there's a couple things you got to remember when we're drinking this gin. He said, first of all, always get the gin in a separate glass and the Squirt in a little bit bigger glass. And when you drink the gin, drink it all at once and don't breathe. And the reason you don't want to breathe is it's nasty and it could make you gag. Anybody who's ever drank any dry gin knows he was telling the truth. You might as well be drinking hair oil or perfume. It's just nasty. I always think if we get somebody into Alcoholics Anonymous and they say they like the taste of gin, we need to get them evaluated. Not to find out if they're an alcoholic, their elements misfire, and that stuff is nasty. But anyway, I said, okay, it makes sense to me. And so I started drinking that stuff. And the other thing he said, that even as sick as I was, it elicited the big why. He said, you got to start to use a lot of pepper on your food. We weren't eating much in those days anyway. And I said, well, what will the pepper do? And he said, well, this gin has been known to hurt your liver. And if you use a lot of pepper on your food, it'll counteract any liver damage. Now, that's what he said. There was a couple reasons I like to drink with Billy Walker. And his brother Tommy Walker drank bar whiskey and chased it with water. Now, there was a couple reasons I liked to drink with Billy and Tommy Walker. One reason is when I was drinking, I had a big mouth. I was a coward. Bad combination. It's just like today. I can't stand a mess, and I can't stand to clean a mess up. I don't think I'm too good to clean a mess up. It just doesn't work out. I've always wanted to live in one of those houses that looks like it's not lived in, but by the time I walk across the room once, it doesn't look like that anymore. I had a girlfriend that kept her house that way. Now, she had a few other problems. She had me, for one thing. But wasn't anything going to happen to me in Bill's bar, but every so often we'd get drunk and wander off someplace. Now, when I got sober, I went up a pant size a year. I needed to. But at Billy Walker's biggest, he was never any bigger than I am right now. But he would attack people. He looked like that dog on the Greyhound bus. Somehow he would just fly. And the other reason I like to drink with Billy Walker, I've tried to figure out some other way to describe this, but I just can't. I've seen a lot of guys in my life that had a lot of what appeared to be a tremendous amount of success picking up women. I've only seen a couple guys that looked like to me they attracted women, and Billy Walker was one of them. Even then, I was just drunk. I wasn't stupid. My game plan was I'm going to hang out right here with Billy Walker and possibly get in on some of the overflow. Well, that's the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar. Now, Thanksgiving season of 1974, I had just came back from California one more time. It was the Vietnam time, and I had been in Vietnam, and I had gotten out of the military in the summer of 1972. A very kind doctor kept me from getting kicked out of the military. It took me 20 years to make direct amends to that guy, but a very kind doctor. Doctors have a lot of power in the military, and he kept me from being kicked out. He shouldn't have, but he did. But it was a different time, and whenever I was in Fremont, Nebraska, I would hang out in Bill's bar. And the Thanksgiving season of 1974, I had just came back from California one more time. I'm very sick now. I'm in that kind of thing where I remember stuff, but I'm not sure if it really happened or if I just think it happened or if I dreamed it up. I don't know if I saw somebody or if it was yesterday or if I even really saw them. And there was a lady and her boyfriend invited another town drunk and I to their house for Thanksgiving dinner. And I'd been in a terrible tractor-trailer accident with this other drunk that we went to their house for Thanksgiving. Now, Libby had a great, big, beautiful Thanksgiving dinner. And remember now, her and her boyfriend were also permanent party in Bill's bar. She cooked this great, big, beautiful Thanksgiving dinner, and she had her kids in. And of course, I wasn't able to eat, and she was packing in beer for me to sip. I kept passing out. I'd wake up, I'm sick, I try to get a little bit to stay down, I think I'm going to get well, I get sick again, and it's going like this. And she had a talk with me that went very much like this. It's funny how that time is so unclear and such a haze, but how what I do remember, it's like it's indelibly etched in my heart. She had a talk with me that went like this. She said, "I've been around alcoholics all my life. I've been married to two alcoholics, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like you at your age." I was 25 years old. She said, "There's a man in town who helped my last ex-husband. My ex-husband's now been sober 1 year. He's got a full-time job. He's paying child support, and he's doing very well. If you want me to, I'll call him." So she called a man by the name of Bob Brannigan. The last day of November of 1974, he made the first call that was ever made on me. Now, I don't remember much of what he did. I know he spent all Saturday afternoon with me, and I only remember two or three things. I know now that what he did is he told me the story of his drinking life and his recovery. He did a traditional 12-step call. But I remember a couple, three things. I remember asking him, "How do you get the willpower to not drink?" And I remember him telling me, "I look on willpower a little bit different than you do. What I think willpower is the way you take that drink, knowing it's going to come back up. That's what I think willpower is." And I remember asking him, "How long since you've drank?" And he said, "If I can make it till September, it'll be 11 years. And he carted me off to the state hospital the next day. That was my introduction. And on the inside, I was dead on the inside. Depending on when you caught me, it might have looked like I knew everything in the world except how to quit drinking and how to shut my own mouth. Or it might have looked like the way it really was, that I didn't have enough dignity to hold my head up. But anyway, I was off to the state hospital. I didn't stay sober. I even got drunk in there, Gemma, drinking that great wine. And at that time, at least, they figure you're not catching on if you're drinking, you know, Mad Dog wine in the state hospital. At that time, they wanted you to pay 1% of your last year's earnings, which I had made $82. And plus, they would have had to bill me. I guess that would have been 82 cents. I didn't have a mailing address. What a dilemma, right? But anyway, I was to get sober 6 months later. I was to get sober Memorial Day weekend. And I sobered up in a motel room. I shouldn't have. About 3 days without a drink, I'm seeing and hearing things that aren't there. But it began a journey. I'm sober a very, very few days, and my great aunt invited me to come and live with her. My great aunt was 75 years old. She's a very cultured, dignified old lady. She spoke three languages, plus she was a lifelong student of Latin. And this is what she said. She said, "If you will go to AA, I have someone in mind who will take you." And I was already going. But I'd sobered up. The first step had moved in my life in that motel room. The first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, / that our lives have become unmanageable. To me, that means I'm dead meat. I can't make it drinking. I can't make it without drinking. What I think surrender happens is when the demons you might get start to look better than the demons you got. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not thinking it would work. I came on a dead run from what I had. What I knew in my heart is I had to find a new way to live or I wanted to die. And I'd had a couple, three plans. About the last couple years of my drinking, I'd been out of the military almost 3 years when I got sober. I'd worked 6 weeks, and I'd had a plan. I'd had several plans. One was to marry a rich woman. Well, that probably wasn't going to happen. I had a plan to get a job. That makes perfect sense when you're drinking, doesn't it? I'm going to go get a job tomorrow. It's sort of like saying I'm not going to drive a car when I'm drinking. That makes perfect sense till I start drinking. Then it doesn't make sense anymore. And my other plan was to kill myself, and I think that that was a much more likely scenario. The very first summer that I was sober, the second step moved in my life. I'm going to rush through these because of our time thing, but we spend entire weekends. I know Bob does a lot of this, and I've done it a number of times myself. We spend entire weekends talking about the 12 steps. I mean, we can go forever talking about perfect spiritual principles, because the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous are perfect. It's my application of them that doesn't rise to that, but they're perfect. There's no conjecture, there's no theory, there's no concepts. They're perfect principles. They're tested and proven. They'll reverse a killer illness, hold a tragic alcoholic in resting the illness for as long as we're around here. The very first summer that I was sober, I wouldn't have been able to put this in words then, but the second step moved in my life. Second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The very first summer I was sober, something shifted. I couldn't have put it in words. I was as terrified as I'd ever been, but what I think happened is a little bit of hope was born. That's what I think that step is. I was sitting out in front of Chapter 5 one night after a meeting about 10 o'clock at night. I sobered up with a guy that I gave him the name almost 31 years ago, Big Harold. And the reason I gave him that name is he was almost 6 foot tall and he weighed 115 pounds. He looked like a prisoner of war. And he told his wife that the first time he saw me, he said, there's one that's really hurting. So I don't know what I must have looked like. But we were sitting on the hood of a car one night after a meeting, the very first summer we were sober, and my buddy looked over at me and said, man, if this thing don't work, there ain't nothing. Well, Alcoholics Anonymous works the best, and you might be able to say only works as a court of last resort. So that step moved in my life through the power of people. It moved in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous literature. I was told to never let a day go by without reading Alcoholics Anonymous literature. I was connected to a couple people, that buddy, and then we had the same sponsor. And it was moving in my life. You know, I did a lot of crazy things when I was drinking, and I've made a lot of mistakes in sobriety, but the most insane thing I could do today would be to take a drink sober. I went through the actions of the third step with my sponsor. The third step has made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood Him. My sponsor took me by the hand, and on our knees we did the third step, prayer. But I know now that what I did really is I turned my wasted and busted life over to my sponsor and to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have turned it over to the God that I understood then, because I hated God and I blamed God for the direction my life had taken. I don't mean anything disregarding by that. I've met many alcoholics in that boat. In fact, I'd go so far, I don't want to pull other people under my tent, but I'd go so far as to say I've never met an alcoholic come to Alcoholics Anonymous that wasn't in spiritual distress. I don't know how you could get in here if you're not in spiritual distress. It's a spiritual illness. So I moved forward into the steps, but what I really did, I just surrendered my wasted and busted life to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what my sponsor taught me was to be dependent on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the more dependence I had on those principles, the more independence I would have as a person. And the fourth step, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I did that. I did it just according to the way the book says. I got all the resentments down there. I got all the fear down there, and I got all the sex stuff down there. My experience with a listener in fifth step is about 90% of people's secrets have to do with sex that they intend to take to the grave with them. I had all kinds of stuff to get through there. There was plenty of resentment, there was plenty of fear, and there was plenty of sex. And the other part of my drinking, not only was this part over here hilarious, there was a part over here that was tragic. One person lost their life because of me and hatred and because of the way I was living. And so I had a lot of stuff to try to get through there, but I got it down on paper. Talk about self-centeredness. I chose for my listener, for my first fifth step sober, a Catholic priest that was a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't interested in being a Catholic, but I had it in my head that a priest couldn't tell. And I picked a grandfatherly old gentleman who had been sober many, many years. And for me, it was perfect. He had his chewing tobacco right in his pocket. He had on those great big pants. If it would have got cold, I could have got in there with him. He had on those great big shoes that people's feet hurt, and he told me to meet me at the rectory at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, and I hit the door, and he said, I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic, and he told me to be prepared for a long talk. I had my inventory there. I was able to get through that stuff, and I had two things. I left there at a little bit after noon, and I had two things happen when I left there that I always hope anybody that I work with has happened. One is the realization came to me that I had come a considerable distance. I had come a long ways. I obviously believed my life was on the line if I was willing to tell all that stuff to God and to another human being. The other thing that was very apparent to me is this would be a terrible place to pull out. I think it's after the, now this is just me, consider it if you want. This is where I think we start to lose our members. I think it looks like we start to lose them down the road a little bit, but I think this is where we start to lose them. I think if you don't have good leadership and good sponsorship, the sixth and seventh step look like filler material. They're the least talked about steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's where mature sobriety started for me. It's where I anchored down. The sixth step says we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. What happened is the sixth step became to my life like the first step was to my drinking. And I anchored down. Mature sobriety started there. Seventh step says humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. I've had incredible things happen from there. That's where it became apparent to me I wasn't just going to walk off and get drunk. Something happened. Something shifted. All kinds of stuff happened, and that's deepened for me over the years. When I was sober 20 years, my sponsor told me, he was polite, but just barely. Mostly he was businesslike. He said, what's wrong with you is you've been socialized. When you get sober, we learn to quit using filthy names when we talk about women, or we quit using racially disparaging terms, but the cancer is still there. And there's a big difference between pulling out roots and lopping off branches. And so what's happened to me over the years is that's been a deepening experience. We're supposed to become colorblind in here. There's no such thing as good girls and bad girls. There's women. Some of them have been kicked around more than others. But what this thing is supposed to do is put me at eye level with the rest of the human race. And the sixth and seventh step are what do that. There's tremendous, tremendous power there. It's a turning point. There's something critical happens there that it looks like to me, if it doesn't happen, people are on a good, good chance of pulling out of here. I think although it looks more like they pull out at the eighth step. But anyway, that's just my little take on it, through my hole in the fence for what it's worth. The eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. We were talking about this today, Leslie and Bob and I. If I've done all the damage, it's not hard for me to become willing. I like to be very literal about that step. It just says I get it down and I become willing. And where I've had trouble with willingness is when there's been spiritual warfare, when I feel like I've been damaged. You know, we say in Alcoholics Anonymous that we can't change the past. That's only a half truth. When I got about this place in the program, my understanding of the past started to shift. I've literally made appointments to go out and see people. And the ninth step says, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I've actually had the experience of going out to see somebody to make amends, and they look different to me afterwards. It didn't look like the same person. My understanding of the past shifted when I did that. It was so powerful. I heard a guy say one time, if you can get to the bottom of the ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous, what you've got is a jet engine for life. And how I understand that is my two biggest problems have always been resentment or fear. In fact, if I had to describe alcoholism in one word, if I had to just get one word, what do you think alcoholism is? I'd say it's fear. But my problems have always been resentment about the past or fear of the future. If I can get to the bottom of the ninth step, I'm connected to the power right now. You got a jet engine for life. I'm not living in the past and I'm not out there anymore. I'm a baseball fan and the big unit's my man. He'll tell you himself, he brings a fastball at almost 100 miles an hour, and he'll tell you himself sometimes when he gets in trouble, he tries to aim it, and you can't aim it. I don't think life can be measured. I'm at my best when I'm just natural, when I forget I'm there. And I think it's the job of the first nine steps to get me in that position where I'm living in the power right now. But I've had amazing things happen with that, And so far, right up till today, I've had some way to make amends to the best of my ability to everything that I've done. What I believe is I have to try to put back in whatever I took out. And what I believe is if I can stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous until I leave out of here, the God of my understanding will say that the account is squared. That's just what I believe. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think it's a nice, kind, gentle way to look at it. Tenth step, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I'll tell you this, I've been a long time in being prompt. There's no doubt about that. But what that step has done for me is it's allowed me to operate on a daily basis, and it's allowed me to try to stay current. It's also a good way for me to keep up with my humanity, to know I'm going to screw stuff up. And just one of the things I like to do with that step, because of where I work and so much of the stuff I do, it's easy to get jaundiced. You know, we live in a world, we got people who are afraid to walk around in our own communities. What I like to do every day is think about the people who have went out of their way to be nice to me, the people who have went out of their way to do things. There's all kinds of stuff with that step that we can do that thing just continues to bloom and to come alive. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. When I first looked at that step when I was a newcomer, that thing seemed so ominous that I could never get any personal value out of it. But what I think is it's intensely practical. What we're doing in here tonight fits well within the 11th step, you know, to seek after. And what I think God's will for me is to not drink alcohol, to practice these principles and carry the message to the best of my ability. I don't have any way of getting money other than working for it, so I think God wants me to work. I got one wife, so I sleep with one woman. I think I can be pretty safe that God's idea for me is to practice the natural virtues like of kindness and honesty and those kind of things. Sobriety's not the end here. What I think our literature says about that in that respect is our real job is to be as maximum service to God and our fellows. So there's work for me to do here. And I think what God's goal for me is, as I understand it, is Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I had a lady one time ask me, this lady was an English teacher, asked me what was the most grabbing word in the 12th step. What I believe about the steps is all 12 of them are equal importance. I don't think that any one step is any more important than the other steps to a well-rounded life. I don't think they're all of equal importance at the same time, but over the long haul, all 12 steps are of equal importance. But a lady asked me, what's the one word in the 12th step that's the most grabbing word? And I guess I guessed every word other than the one she said. And she said the word that makes the 12th step go is the word "the," because the word "the" explains where a spiritual awakening comes from. It's the result of the first 11 steps. My spirit's been awakened. I'm not the same person I was. I've practiced these principles. I've carried this message. I've had wonderful things happen with carrying this message. I gave a guy his last drink over 30 years ago, still sober. I can never remember. He either asked for gin and I gave him vodka, or he asked for vodka and I gave him gin. I don't know which one it was. He was too drunk to get off the floor, but he immediately knew I gave him the wrong kind of booze. But I've had all kinds of things happen. I had a guy that I sponsored one time. I sponsored him for 7 years, gave him his chip every year for 7 years. And after he'd been sober 7 years, he moved to St. Louis with the buyout with Union Pacific Railroad. And he did what a lot of people do when he moved. He didn't quit Alcoholics Anonymous, but he didn't anchor down. And about a year after that, he started drinking. And about a year after that, he took his own life. So, you know, I've had an opportunity to do these things here and to be here, and all kinds of things happen. I want to close up real fast, the last couple of minutes, with what I learned about that 8-year experience and that 19 and a half year experience, is that it felt like I was being choked spiritually and like I was going to die. And both of those experiences lasted between 6 months and a year. And what I learned is that the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, if practiced, are slightly more powerful than whatever the problem is. I think when we first look at it, it looks like problems can get us out of here. Problems can't get us out of here. I've had far more problems in sobriety than I ever had drinking. I don't know many people who haven't. I've had to grow up here. I've had to take my place. So what we have here is a way of life that makes drinking impossible if we'll continue to stay together, practice these principles to the best of our ability. So Bob, I really appreciate you inviting me here. It's been a real honor to be in your presence. And by the grace of God, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would like to thank you for my life.